But in any case, I'd graduated 14th in my class. I was on my way to the University of Pittsburgh for undergrad with a half tuition scholarship. All of my tuition was essentially paid for out of grants and that scholarship. And the loans were really only for, you know, in other words, I was pretty well set as far as school was concerned. But somehow I just didn't do so well in my AP physics exam. I got a 2, I believe, out of, and it's a 5-point scale. But in any case, the story goes that as I'm cleaning out my locker, she pulls me into her office and starts to berate me about how could I let the black community in Mount Vernon down? How could I let blacks in Mount Vernon High School down? How could I let my people down? There's no way that you could possibly have it as tough as any of us did in the Civil Rights generation. And I'm thinking to myself, well, let's see, I'm from a family of abuse. I'm the 2nd of 6 kids. My mom is getting welfare payments of the equivalent of $16,000 a year, living in the 3rd richest county in the United States and living in the New York City area. How much worse can I possibly have it in 1987? But, you know, that's what I'm thinking as she's saying all of this. And then she says something which I thought was very strange. And she says that, you know, you couldn't have had as tough as we did because we marched with King. And I didn't know what to say to that. I mean, I'm like, what does that have to do with what I'm going through, for one thing? Number two is what I'm thinking is, so what? Even if you did march with King, there are so many thousands of other people who marched with King. And it might have been a life-changing experience for them. It might not have been. But that's your experience. It doesn't negate what I'm going through. But my point is that with that particular vignette, it kind of talks about the generation gap to some extent between older African Americans and younger African Americans, particularly from my generation, the Generation X generation, where we're the generation that follows immediately after the Civil Rights Movement. And so are therefore expected, we're expected at least to take up the mantle. And once it came to light that in some respects, the media treated us as slackers, so therefore, we're not really the ones who are ready to take up this mantle, that the civil rights generation still has to be the generation that leads us to the so-called promised land of American equality and freedom. So, I mean, that's the point of that story, but it is an interesting story because it also shapes how I think about multiculturalism.
Now, you go to the University of Pittsburgh, and you get your... Did you plan to major in history when you went there?
No. Mm-hmm. Planned to major in computer science. I thought I liked it. My mom said you can make pretty good money doing it. And at the time, I thought pretty good money was $25,000 a year. So that's what I initially majored in. And then about my third semester, I found myself miserable. I was still doing pretty well. I mean, I wasn't failing or anything, but I was pretty miserable with it. Knew I loved history and always loved history. And just decided that middle of that semester, my third semester, to switch over to history. Mm-hmm. My mom didn't like it, but that's okay. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure if she's gotten over it, but you know, I hope she has, at least anyway.
All right, you got your master's and your bachelor's there. And then you went next door to Carnegie Mellon.
Right.
Yeah. Here you are in up south. That's my term. Because I also went to the University of Pittsburgh. And I think it's one of the most bigoted cities in the country. Anyhow, how did you get on to multiculturalism?
About 14 years ago this month, actually, I started was finishing up my undergrad at University of Pittsburgh, knew I was going to graduate school, didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew how I was going. And started reading the newspaper just to see, you know, in case I didn't get in or in case I didn't get money to go, what kind of jobs I could find. But as I was reading, I found a New York Times article that was dealing with this whole issue of multiculturalism in the state of New York, how there are these two sides, these Afrocentrics over here and these traditionalists over there, who are arguing over whether multiculturalism was fit for a social studies curriculum K-12 in New York State's public schools. And then reading through all of that and looking at all those articles, because these articles go back to April, you can look at May of 91, you can look at June of 91, and the argument basically boiled down to this. Essentially, white scholars were afraid to put a multicultural curriculum that treated African Americans as a major player in the development of American culture essentially as equals. They didn't like that idea. And that we were talking about the founding fathers as these great, not as great men, but also slave owners. Whereas Afrocentrics didn't think the curriculum went far enough. It needed to be more African-centered, more about what Africans, people of African descent did before to
get. Is this the Jeffries conflict in New York State?
It's Jeffries, it's Schlesinger, it's a host of other people.
Yes. In fact, included the wife of our current vice president, Lynn Cheney.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So tell our listeners who Jeffries was and how that controversy developed.
Jeffries was a professor at CCNY, Community College of New York, City College of New York, excuse me. And he was just one of a number of Afrocentrists in the late 80s and early 90s who came out with a bunch of ideas around creating an African-centered curriculum, not only at the college level, but at the high school and junior high school level. They were advocating that this would create really academic an atmosphere of academic achievement for African Americans through bringing up the self-esteem of African Americans, particularly African American males. And so they concentrated on what Africans did before they came to the Americas, ancient Egypt, the kingdoms of sub-Saharan Africa, and so on and so forth. Rather than trying to deal with the realities of slavery, the dehumanization of slavery, and how Africans in America managed to rise above that, which, by the way, is another inspiring story, but they didn't want to deal with that. In terms of Afrocentrists, as far as Afrocentrists go, he's pretty far and pretty radical even among Afrocentrists, because his argument essentially is that American culture doesn't have anything of value for people of African descent. That's essentially his argument.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you say about people on the other side, let me read what you wrote. It says, if one truly examines the arguments of people like Schlesinger, Ravitch, Bennett, D'Souza, and Lynn Cheney, one would see that there is not much difference between them and the views of white supremacy groups. There's not much difference between an argument for the preservation of the Western canon and the total assimilation of other cultures and one that advocates the purity of the white race. Both arguments are based in fear and the belief that because Western culture has expanded its influence over the past half millennia, it is automatically better. Expand on that for our listeners. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's just take what I just said. If you're a member of the KKK, and just using them as an example, or any the Aryan group, your argument is that white culture, whatever white culture happens to be, whether it's from ancient Greece and Rome, whether it's from Western Europe, whether it's from Germany, whether it's what America proclaims itself to be as a Western society, that this is automatically better than anything that comes along, regardless of whether it contributed to the development of Western culture, whether it contributed to the development of American culture in general. So when African Americans come out and say, whether it happened, or whites who come out and say that African Americans have contributed to the development of American culture in all these various ways, whether it happens to be something as superficial as popular culture and hip hop and music, or something as deep as putting America's feet to the fire around issues of equality and issues of freedom and how we understand those sorts of ideals, we're written off. We're written off as essentially invalid. There's no way that we could have contributed to that. And even if we did, we didn't contribute it in all the ways that we say we did. Basically saying that anybody who makes that argument, whether we're talking about Du Bois or Cornel West, is essentially a liar. And there's not much difference between those two arguments. The only difference is that people like Ravitch and people like Bennett and people like Lynn Cheney would never want to resort to violence to maintain the supremacy of white culture. So subtler ways of oppression, economic, educational, and others are better than just out-and-out lynching people. And that's really the only difference.
No, there's another difference. One difference is you can make a lot of money being a D'Souza.
That's true. Absolutely.
Because every television talk show will get you on to help you sell your book. Same thing with Lynn Cheney. Same thing with Schlesinger. It is extremely profitable to promote that extreme because it stimulates the white juices. That's my opinion.